Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew, and tonight I'd like to welcome author and researcher of everything from alternative history to ufology and conspiracy culture, and a true magician, Gordon White. How you doing tonight, Gordon?
I'm doing really well. Thank you for having me.
Very good. Now, since it's your first time on the show, go ahead and give us a little bit about your background and what brought you to your research.
Sure. So I've been doing this professionally for a little while, maybe about 5 years, writing books and so on. I born and raised Australian, lived overseas for about 15 years, New Zealand, London, and so on. And I have a family background in the Pacific. My grandfather was part of colonial administration in places like Nauru and New Guinea. And so the antiquity of that little corner of the world has always been very interesting to me. So, I mean, we would go diving and whatever on various different islands growing up and so on. So that kind of the stories that get missed out of official history tantalized me from fairly early on. And from a practicing magical perspective, I had some strange dreams when I was about 13, which I can no longer remember, and sort of woke up and stole some money from my mother's purse and walked down the hill to an independent bookstore, which existed back then, and bought a few books and a pack of cigarettes and sat in the grandstand on the way home and read them. So it began quite early and strangely, I guess, for me. Professionally, I've worked for BBC and Discovery Channel, and I've done like data analytics and demographic analysis before I started doing this full time. So it's a kind of blend of a family experience, but also professional training in sometimes useful analytic processes like data analysis.
Very good. And what was it that kind of opened your eyes to the world behind our world, and that, you know, things weren't exactly as we're being told in the history books and what they show us on TV and media?
It was a couple of things, I suppose. So as I was finishing up high school, in Australia, you have, I don't know how it is around the rest of the world, but you can take extra modules of a course you're particularly interested in. So I did 3-unit ancient history, which was the maximum you could do. And we did Old Kingdom burial customs. And this was, so I'm in school learning this at the same time that Graham Hancock's book, Heaven's Mirror, and the Channel 4 series came out. And and that was my first indication. Part of it is it's dumbed down for high school students, so I couldn't be that. It's not just the fact that it's some kind of vast overarching conspiracy. I was just a kid at the time, but it sort of immediately became apparent when you looked at, well, this is the official stuff, and here's some guy who appears to know what he's doing or talking about, suggesting that there's some big problems with this official stuff. So I was kind of concurrently learning official and unofficial history at the same time. And you just, it's the politics of power and narrative. You kind of learn that the people who are in power get to tell you what is and isn't reality. And that's rarely for your benefit.
Now, would you agree that the world of the magical or metaphysical and occult knowledge, it seems to be suppressed, and that kind of knowledge seems to be saved for, you know, our elites or the people in power? Is that something you'd agree with?
Some of it, yes. If we're talking specifically about European cultures, so Western cultures generally speaking, magic never really went away from sort of the fall of the classical world and all through Christian Europe and out into the empires. You have people doing dowsing and praying to saints and all this kind of stuff. So magic actually never went away. That said, there are certain practices, particularly to do with, you know, astronomy and astrology and laying out of buildings and demonic evocation and so on, that either required you to be able to read for a start, which automatically restricted it, and you'd be killed if you had these books. But yeah, clearly, if you look at things like the rearrangement of the Vatican and certain plans for London after the fire, educated people who were close to either the Pope or the King were very interested in the relationship of buildings of power and the stars and so on. So there's absolutely an elite magical language that is restricted. Partly it's restricted because most of the time people couldn't read, but magic is much wider than that. Magic is herbalism and praying to saints and throwing walnuts in the fire to hear what the sound of your, you know, husband's name's going to be. It's all that kind of stuff as well. But there are absolutely praxis that have historically been associated with power, and I think still are.
Now, as far as interaction with the spirit world, or even the interdimensional, or what you may even call extraterrestrial, any kind of interaction with something non-human, it seems like that was more prevalent in ancient times. They used to openly commune with spirits than it is today. Is that something you would agree with?
I would say so, and there are a number of reasons for that. There, like Christianity, a lot of people don't know this, basically inherited Imperial Rome's laws around magic. So the Romans were deeply suspicious of things like astrology and magic anyway, because these things could be used against the empire, particularly astrology and so on. They were quite squeamish about it. So that being said, they lived in a more spirit-haunted world. And so there's a number of reasons for it. We do have laws throughout, and we've had, you know, witch trials and all these kind of things over the last 1800 years. But we also kind of broke our model of reality, the Cartesian split about 300 years ago. And the idea that thoughts that are in your head are just in your head, and thoughts aren't attached to the physical. So we have like dualism and a diminishment of things like the imagination and dreams as being not having any kind of reality. And so there's a whole bunch of reasons why I think it's correct to say that humans are in continuous interaction with the spirit world. We just, modern Westerns, are unaware of it because we've broken our model. So I think there's a whole bunch of reasons why. And one of them is that. One of them is that we're sort of laboring under this ludicrous materialist notion of how reality works. And it's just, it's hilarious. It's like a fish not knowing what water is.
Right. And also the communing with what they would consider the gods. That seems like that's something that, you know, we don't see anymore. And what would they consider gods? Is this actual entities, or would it be representations of certain energies or even planets?
All of the above, depending on where you are in the timeline. So, one of the reasons that Socrates was killed was that it was a hit job. He was old. It didn't matter. Was that the accusations against him, where he was essentially corrupting the youth against the existence of gods, infecting them with atheism, which he denied, but he was always very gnomic about what he thought the gods were. And so across the sort of classical Greece and up into the early Christian era, gods are different things. So Hecate has been described as an angel and a demon. When Christianity is trying to form out of the sort of emerging monotheism of classical Greece, people, what do you do in that situation when you think that Athena and Hecate and all these beings exist, and they clearly exist, they've got temples and they have miracles and things. So you're trying to fit them into a schema, and people have tried different things, like them all being emanations of the one God, or them being angels or demons that fit in this new cosmology. And some people in the classical world in particular were just flat out atheists, like, no, I don't think the gods exist. That's what happens. And it happened to astrology as well. There have been different efforts to try and science it up. It never was planetary powers beaming down like a radio telescope or something onto the earth. They were just signs in the sky about things that were going to happen. So it's because magic has had such a long history, depending on where you are, there have been a whole bunch of different theories as to how or why it might work to account for the fact that it does.
Right. Now, when do you think the communing with the gods stopped? Because at some point, we stopped hearing about it throughout history, that there was, you know, regular communication or, you know, worshiping of these different gods.
If we're talking about in a European context, we could probably pinpoint that, because the reality is for, you know, the rest of the world, they kind of didn't. So there are different ways of interacting or communing with the gods, of course. So you have mystery schools and things like the Eleusinian Mysteries actually ran for 1,000 years. That's really long. That's like the longest running psychedelic project in recorded history, right? So there's versions like that. You would also have a process called incubation, where you would go into a temple and sleep. and the gods of that particular temple would come and speak to you. And this was normal kind of medical praxis in the classical world. So there's a bunch of different ways of how people commune with God specifically. And they essentially stopped, they officially stopped when they were banned. And they were banned on a city-by-city basis, so Alexandria and Rome and so on, as the, you know, as Europe Christianized. That's when we stopped officially doing things like that. I would argue that it probably had a kind of rain shadow of another 150 years of people kind of quietly doing it. But I think we stopped haphazardly, depending on which piece it was, as laws changed around the world. And then, of course, but like, it's one of those things you have to argue or think for yourself, did it stop or did it just change the name? Because all of a sudden you have in early Christian Europe people who would be staying up all night praying in their little chapel or and, you know, different, the emergence of the rosary and books of days and hours and little devotional books to the Virgin Mary and so on. You think, well, this is the same thing. You're using nighttime and single focus to, ritually it's the same thing. You're using nighttime and single focus to interact with whatever you happen to think it is, the inside of your head, gods, or so on. So it's one of the things that I find fascinating about humans is we kind of can't not do this. We just maybe had better and worse ways of describing it through time.
And I find it interesting that, you know, certain gods, whether if they changed or if they've been forgotten, do they not exist if we don't believe in them, if we don't give them the power, if they are indeed real entities? What happens? Are they still in existence? You know, have you ever done any thought on that?
Yeah, loads. There's a pre-Socratic philosopher who was called Parmenides, and he basically said, if you can think of something, it has some form of existence, or you wouldn't be able to think about it. And I really like this idea. So there is, like, if think about a unicorn riding a rocket across Paraguay. Like, because you can think of that, that idea has some form of existence. And this is what you get. We're coming back to, like, what are entities and what are ideas and can they fade? The trouble with all of these discussions, and it's an exciting discussion to have, is to get to that baseline metaphysics of what you think a thought is or what you think the imagination is. Is the imagination different to the spirit world? And if you look at a philosopher like Parmenides, there are opportunities to have a blended model where the imagination can be identical to the spirit world. It's just that there are things that are in it that are maybe more dense, more hyper-dense, or so on. So some things, maybe they faded, but if we can think of them, according to Parmenides, it has some form of existence. When it comes to how, I have some shortcuts to kind of describe this stuff, which is, for instance, I think the gods are quote-unquote in our heads, but I think spirits are external and real. Now, I use that as a kind of way of framing the discussion rather than it being a hard and fast rule, because the gods are quite a good match to human psychology and archetypes and so on. But then you have spirits of caves, and you have spirits that haunt old bones, and you have, you know, demons in lakes and things, which seems unlikely that's like archetypal in the same way that a goddess of love or a god of war is archetypal. So I kind of think of it that way. The spirits very often persisted as things like demons and local legends and all that kind of stuff. And the gods kind of changed into maybe different archangels and the Virgin Mary and so on, because they're possibly more imaginally structural is a way of describing it, maybe.
Now, what are your thoughts on, say, demonic possession versus invoking a spirit? You know, it seems we hear now about, you know, a lot of demonic possession and how it relates to mainly, you know, the Catholic Church and priests performing exorcisms to rid the person of these spirits. Just give us a bit about your thoughts on that. You know, what is the difference between the two and, you know, how sure. It relates to the, you know, Catholicism and what they're doing with that.
Sure. Funnily enough, exorcism was Christianity's killer app when it showed up. That was in the first few centuries of Christianity. the fact that you could use this guy's name to expel demons was the killer app. And so, in fact, exorcism came first. Exorcism came first. The first use of the term conjurer, which is what we use when we're talking about evoking demons in a grimoiric sense, was applied to priests who were conjuring demons out of people or out of houses. Because follow the logic of this. If you can use these words to tell a demon to get out of you, that means you can use these words to kind of boss a demon around. So exorcism is baked into the very beginnings of Christianity as a praxis in Europe, which is fascinating, I think, because demons predate, like the classical world is awash with demons, right? And here's this killer app to get rid of them. So yeah, the difference there, so historically exorcism comes first, and then over about an 800-year period, you start to get in kind of clerical schools and monasteries and areas where people could write and officially had the power to do these things. You start to get the development of grimoires. You get the development of, well, if I use these words to keep myself safe in this circle, I can still bust this around. And the really flimsy and sometimes cute, sometimes correct theological justification for doing so, which is God has set man to do this and all this kind of stuff, right? The kind of things you find in with priests and monasteries and all that kind of thing. So that those things come first, and it develops that way. As for the difference between evoking a demon and demonic possession, well, this is a kind of wider metaphysical conversation, and I'll just say this to start with. I don't think you can have a useful map of contemporary politics without an understanding of demons. And I don't think, and particularly in the West, when I think there are any number of people, powerful people, and even just less so, that have mild cases of demonic possession to extreme cases that they're unaware of. Now, this is not that, that sounds kind of crazy, but actually that brings our culture back into alignment with spirit-based cultures around the world, whether they're in the Amazon or New Guinea or China or wherever. There is this idea that because we are embedded in the spirit world, we can pick this stuff up, and it's kind of like just walking through pollution or what have you. So when it comes to what's the difference between evocation and demonic possession, there is a reason when you look at the grimoires, it's kind of like the early days of scuba diving. The amount of protective stuff you need and the precision and things that you need to do and get the timing right, it's because this is serious business, and it's not something to kind of play around with, because yeah, you're dealing with spirits that, you don't have to call them demons. You can say that they're spirits that are hostile to mankind or ambivalent or whatever. But I call it extra-dimensional diplomacy. And if you're dealing with the nasty ones, there are certain precautions you take. And because we don't, and frankly rarely believe in things like demons anymore, they can kind of run rampant. So it doesn't surprise me. I mean, the article came out a year and a bit ago, but there's a shortage of exorcists in the Roman Church because, right, like, the place is awash with demonic possessions. And these guys, like, I mean, my father's a psychiatrist, and my grandparents are dead, but they were, like, hardcore Catholic. So we have priests and psychiatrists in our orbit. And let me tell you, the priests, they're not, for all their many, many sins, generally they're not savage, if you want to say, in their beliefs. Like, they don't, if someone has depression, they'll say, you've got depression. Like, it won't be, oh, you've clearly got a demon, we'll break out the holy water. Like, it's a last resort for them. It's really, like, they will refer to, as they should, to psychologists and counselors and psychiatrists first. And then at the end of it, if it's a demon, then, you know, they break out the toys. But the fact that they've got a shortage of them at the moment, I think is a fascinating commentary on our world.
That is fascinating, and I heard that, and I was wondering if it's really, you know, a rise in the amount of possessions, or are we just hearing about it more because of the internet and the ease of access of information? But if you're saying that there's a shortage of priests, that's something different.
Yeah. It's, you have to be specifically trained for it, and they have a shortage of priests in whatever the Exorcism Academy is in Rome. So yeah, that appears to be it. They have a shortage of them. And it's one of those funny things that's happened to the church over the 20th century. When they, after Vatican II, as they try to, and it was a mistake, but as they try to get more contemporary, people don't go to a church for that. They want the Latin and the incense and the funny robes, right? But so they have this tech, and it's the core tech. It's the first thing Christians did. which is exorcism, and they try to pretend they don't have it, although that's officially a thing, because, you know, the church can't be wrong and blah, blah, blah. Like, it's officially a thing. And all of a sudden, last 4 or 5 years, they need to break it out. And it's a really, I find it fascinating. It's a fascinating situation for them to be in, that they have to turn around and go, actually, probably all that stuff that we were pretending wasn't real in the hopes that we could fit in with the modern world, it's actually kind of real.
That is fascinating. And I wonder what actually changed to cause the increase in this activity.
I couldn't tell you. Your guess would be as good as mine. It's exciting to guess at, but I couldn't tell you what it is. It could just be what happens now. There might be an astrological reason. I would guess it's behavioral. So more of us are, and I'm very pro entheogens and all that kind of stuff, but more of us are altered on a daily basis chemically, the amount of prescription medications and so on. So I would speculate. My first guess would be that we've kind of left the back window of our mind unlocked a bit more than we previously used to. And that's kind of all it takes eventually. That would be my best guess, but literally just a guess.
Now, I want to get back to a little bit of the ancient civilizations. Now, especially with Sumeria, it opens up, you know, a lot of talk about intervention with, you know, different entities and basically the genetic manipulation of humans, just because of how advanced the Sumerian culture was. What are your thoughts on that in the whole Sumerian culture?
If we're talking about the Sitchin hypothesis, I have a lot of affection for him. I don't think he was right, but he was the... How to describe this? He was the right kind of wrong. So Sitchin looked at the translations, and he taught himself all those languages, all the hit job things that people say. Like, he stood by his interpretations, but he looked at the interpretations and said, well, I think this is a rocket ship, and I think this is what they're talking about, and all this kind of stuff. And he was the right kind of wrong, because the official explanation for Sumer in general is crap. And so he thought, well, the way I'm going to model this is it's, you know, nuclear-powered rocket ships and people coming to, and aliens coming to build humans to mine gold to save the atmosphere of their home planet and all this. And that's not, like, so that's what I mean by, like, he's the right kind of wrong, because he saw that there's something weird as shit in the origins of Sumer, and that was his guess. Now, this comes back to that metaphysics thing. In my first book, Starships, A Prehistory of the Spirits, is kind of entirely about this, which is one of the problems with an ancient alien. Like, the broadly ancient alien thesis is that it still relies on materialism. So you kind of look at the remarkable complexity of Sumer emerging like that overnight. Not quite true. I mean, there was a flooding of the Arabian Gulf. But anyway, emerging like that overnight, and you go, well, this requires an explanation. And because you're a materialist, like, well, it has to be aliens coming to help people. Well, what if spirits are real? And here's the thing. And what if we're talking about non-physical contact? My favorite is the Dogon, right? Because they clearly know stuff about Sirius that they didn't. Like, the idea that that's been debunked is rubbish. They have some astronomical knowledge that they shouldn't have. Now, you don't need to go all the way to, therefore, Sirians got in a spaceship and flew over here and taught them stuff. Because I kind of think, like, they'd have more detailed information if that had happened. But we have 120 to 150 years of psi research to show that things like telepathy are real. So why can we not have non-physical interaction or interaction with non-physical entities as a model? And all of a sudden, you don't need to go looking for nuclear-powered rocket ships, you know, in the Arabian Gulf, because you go, okay, well, clearly they had contact with something. And this is kind of my broader thesis. I have a presentation in the premium members area called Campfire's Edge, which is, I think, human culture increases and decreases in complexity depending on what kind of quote-unquote spirit interactions we're having and what the intensity of them is. So they obviously got pretty good at something that taught them some very specific things. And it looks to me like a pact. Because kind of emerging out of the gloom of prehistory, fully formed, are all these laws and rules. And it kind of looks like a pact to me. It kind of looks like, okay, well, and that's literally around the world, the story you get, that the demons are the teachers of the arts of civilization to mankind, right? So metallurgy and building and astronomy and all this, the demons taught us. We don't know why, but they did. And it kind of looks like a pact. It kind of looks like, well, we'll give you urbanization skills. And I have no idea what was on that contract. I mean, not an actual contract. I have no idea what's on it, but it looks like some sort of trade or interaction. And so Suma is weird, and you cannot have a particularly satisfactory model of its origins without it getting even weirder. And you can go to the Aliens one. I don't think you need to. I'm pro-Aliens, but I don't think you need it for the model. Or you can go to some sort of spirit interaction one, because the official one is still kind of like, oh, people were wandering around and then they hung out and they put some grain in the ground and all this. And we know archaeologically that the sequence of things like agriculture and the development of urbanization and social hierarchy, they didn't all come together in the sequence that we're told. They didn't sort of go, learn some grain, had a small hierarchy, we had a surplus, so we invented priests, and like that kind of mid-20th century idea. It's not correct archaeologically. It just isn't. So you need, and funnily enough, because I have a bunch of books on Sumer, that's basically chapter one. Chapter one is like, oh, they learn how to do grain so that they would have surplus. So that, and it's that mechanical, mechanistic story. And it's so they don't have an origin. So if anything, even if you are an Aliens guy rather than a Spirits guy, you're kind of further ahead. You're kind of further ahead than the official book. Because at least you're giving it a shot.
Right. And now moving forward in history, it seems like Egypt was one of the last real civilizations to understand magic and the stars and, the afterlife. Would you agree with that?
Sure.
Yeah. So
I think you went quiet again. Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead and talk a little bit about, you know, what happened with Egypt, as far as how that whole, civilization came to end with Rome.
Sure. Egypt, people like think it, if you don't look into it with sufficient nuance, if it's sort of a first glance, you kind of think it all happened at once, right? and lack an appreciation of just how long even dynastic civilization ran for rather than pre-dynastic. So even at official dating, you're kind of looking at 3000 BC for some of the earliest pyramids, right? So, and then Cleopatra and Caesar is basically around the time of Christ. So you've got this 3000 year run up. Now, when do we date the start of Western quote unquote civilization from? Do we date it from, it's either 2000, or you could date it from the Industrial Revolution, so it's 300, or you could date it from the printing press, and it's 1000. So, and this is just dynastic Egypt. People have been living along the Nile River for 100,000 years. Like, archaeologically, they're there. And the dates for the dynastic period are, at least the start of it, is a little contentious, right? So what is useful when thinking about Egypt is to think of the Old Kingdom, which is the sort of first of the three in the dynastic era, not as the beginning, but it basically is the end of the Neolithic, as the end of a 20,000 year exploration of essentially the power of stone, in the same way that we, with the last, say, 2,000 years and a bit, we started looking at metal and the power of metal and chemicals and so on. So we're sort of in an age of chemistry. That was the fulfillment of a sort of 10,000, 15,000 year experiment in what stone can do. And that's one of the reasons these buildings, these structures are so remarkable. But there's also clearly a language to it that we've lost, like the different stones doing different things and their resonant capacities and all this kind of stuff. So the Old Kingdom was playing a very different game, and pretty much at the end of the Old Kingdom, First Intermediate Period, Middle Kingdom. And the thing that people think about is Egypt is the New Kingdom, right? And you can tell by the time you're in the late Middle and then the New Kingdom that they're kind of running off these ideas that people in the Old Kingdom knew but they're not really sure why. Like, so some of the ratios are the same, and the temples have resonant capacities. And I'm not saying they weren't good at magic and astronomy and all that, because they absolutely were. But there was just something different about the old kingdom and its and mankind's relationship to the stars and what that means for the spirit world that is just, like, funny enough, alien. It's just alien. They were. It was the fulfillment or the end point of a 10,000-year experiment with stone. And you start to see all those different techniques and little ideas about what the stars were and where we go after we die and all that kind of democratized through beginning in the Middle Kingdom. So the different star spirits, which are called Deccan, start to show up in common as coffins. And before they did it, this was something the king as the sort of god's representative on earth and a sort of shaman for all of Egypt who would have to navigate and negotiate the happiness of the spirit world and the living. It was his job to make sure all of that stuff was right. So you clearly see, as it's kind of democratizing, people trying to go, well, we've lost that, so but these star spirits are real. And it's this kind of, I find, glorious, messy evolution. But the Egyptians were, until you get to the Hellenistic era, so until the Ptolemaics. So when Alexander died, he put, you know, he split the empire into three, and Ptolemy, one of his generals, got Egypt. And so you start to get that kind of Greco-Babylonian blend of things like planets. But before that, the Egyptians were about the stars. That was their kind of deal. And certain stars in particular, and what they mean and how, what they signify. And it's just like nothing else. And it's that kind of fulfillment of stone and earth and star and place. And they're so good at it. And you look at it and go, it's like looking at I could not rebuild a Ferrari, right? But it's like looking at a Ferrari in pieces. I look at it and go, this is remarkable. And I will never be able to drive it.
Right. And what are your thoughts on maybe the true purposes and uses for the pyramids?
The pyramids were immortality machines, as far as I can tell. And I mean that metaphorically, although they were designed for the, shall we say, non-physical immortality. I don't mean it in the sense that they were attempting to remain in a physical form their entire life. Herodotus himself said they weren't tombs. Like, the Khufu was buried near the pyramid, not in it. So this idea that they were tombs is wrong. They were, particularly when it comes to Giza, I think Giza was a 10,000-year... So the land of the dead is on the west of the Nile, right? The western edge, western bank of the Nile. That's where Giza is. And Giza has all these subterranean, because of the geology of the area, it has all these subterranean caves, and it's on the western edge. So it's in the land of the dead, and it's got all these caves, and people have been living there for 100,000 years. So this place has essentially been a, and when I say metaphor, I mean, like, this was the afterlife, but it was also a place to reenact. And when you do a ritual in ancient Egypt, like, it is identical to the thing that you are ritualizing. So it's both the afterlife and a place to ritualize afterlife behavior. So I think the actual Giza area has been the land of the dead for a very long time, which kind of makes moot the point of when the pyramids were built. But nevertheless, they were over a much longer time period, because I think this was a ceremonial, kind of like a theme park land of the dead. And you would go there and do the rituals, because you're in the land of the dead, that would ensure your immortality. And that's kind of why you have the Orion belt style correlation, because Orion is, of course, Osiris and all that kind of stuff. So, and this is also, I think, why you get people 2,000 years later, when the pyramids are covered in sand, and, you know, the Sphinx is well and truly covered in sand, and it's still kind of known as a necropolis. So in the Hellenistic and Roman era, you'll have people just kind of like tipping the bodies of their relatives down shafts in Giza. Like, so you have these corpses that you'll find that are sort of soaked in bitumen from 100 AD, dropped in these old kingdom shaft tombs, because it was the land of the dead. You've got to put your grandma somewhere.
Right, that is fascinating. Now, I want to shift a little bit into, well, what are your thoughts basically on the possibility that we could be living in a multidimensional existence where we live, where there is, you know, possible multiple timelines occurring at the same time?
Yeah. Well, in terms of multidimensionality, sure. I don't necessarily like the many worlds hypothesis. I think it's a fudge. I'm not a fan of it. It's a fudge to keep materialism going. So I don't know where we have time so wrong. The fact that we can kind of remember future events and all that kind of stuff means we've got time so completely wrong that when you're talking about, do you think there are multiple timelines and so on, like, yeah, probably. But I would suggest that step one is that we kind of do a bit of work on getting time right, because what you're seeing with multiple timeline effects is just, for me at the moment, an indication that, well, this is just evidence that we haven't got time right. Not that we ever will, you know what I mean, but I just think we need a better model for it. But the short answer is yes. I don't necessarily use the term dimension. I've just kind of gone back to really analog terms, so spirit world and kind of hyper thickness and that kind of thing, rather than saying, oh, it's in extra dimensions and so on. It's all the same. You're just re-describing the same thing, right? But like, the short answer is yes. If you hold a spirit world in any fashion, then you were talking in dimensions, at least for sure.
That being said, what's your thoughts on the whole Mandela effect? I'm still, you know, I have no idea what to think about this, if it's a real thing or if it's just kind of like just some weird subconscious thing or what?
Yeah, me neither. It's very odd things to... The examples are kind of like really strange things to sort of bleed between timelines or so on. Now, that being said, I don't put anything past the kind of breakaway civilization style technologies to either be able to create this as a mass effect or delusion, or literally to do it, or to alter timelines or so on. You've had 60 years and unlimited money to be able to do it. I'd be disappointed if they didn't have it, frankly. I'm not sure. It might just be an unusual sort of mass psychological artifact of the internet age. Remember, we haven't been connected like this ever. So if we don't really know how improperly remembered things move between minds when we're all so hyper-connected. So it could just be a phenomenon of a digital world, or it could be a thing. But what was it? The Berenstain Bears and Nelson Mandela are like the two main ones. I don't know. I'm sure kind of strange stuff like that happens all the time. Who knows?
What are your thoughts on large like catastrophes or even orchestrated events, maybe events like 9/11 being some sort of occult ritual?
Honestly, when it comes to 9/11, I think that is almost a bit backwards. So my read on the presence of symbolism, and more importantly than the symbolism, is the use of dates and times to match things. So the fact that whatever hit the Pentagon, quote-unquote plane, that hit the Pentagon did so on the day of the groundbreaking of the actual Pentagon opening ceremony, right? So what you're doing there is you're ritually re-breaking the ground as you pivot this organization. So what you see is a whole bunch of ritual effects that, like, if I was going to do it, there are a bunch of magical techniques, and there's not just one. There's like five or six different things, matching to dates and using different words and symbols and so on to just kind of make it a bit more likely that you're going to succeed, because magic is essentially probability enhancement. So when you see ritual effects in an event like 9/11, to my, I don't want to say professional eyes, but like to my magical eyes, this looks like, yes, whatever vast teams were involved in organizing this have some awareness of magic, and they were using it. And I don't think that means that, like, Cheney and Rumsfeld and everyone are ritual magicians. I think it's way down the line. I think by the time it gets to, like, fulfillment teams, there are certain things that you can do to just make it a little bit more likely. And I don't think they would give a fuck. It's just like, let's get it done. I don't think they give a fuck. So I don't think it's right to see some kind of really unusual occult symbolism in it, because it's there. But all of the attempts I've seen to kind of interpret what that was for, if it was a ritual, isn't very good magic. It's like, that's not right. But they're nevertheless there. So I might be wrong. It might have been a ritual. But the presence of occult symbolism, and the crucial thing is the doubling up of dates for things like the groundbreaking of the Pentagon. That's really good magic. That's the kind of stuff that makes me think magic was put into it rather than it be a magical thing.
Very interesting. Now, what are your thoughts on today? What's going on right now? We live in very strange times. You know, with Trump being the president, and then they have this whole QAnon movement where, you know, people are supposedly waking up to everything going on, and there's going to be this big cleansing of the cabal, and, you know, all this weird stuff going on that I never thought I'd see in my lifetime. Just kind of give us your take on what's going on nowadays.
Sure. This comes back to when I said before, of the demonic. I also don't think you can understand politics or geopolitics or kind of like the wider what's going on without some kind of cycle model. So that can be astrology. Astrology in the longer cycles works quite well for that. I'm a huge fan of Martin Armstrong and his work with, and he's, you know, he's got this cycle-based theory and an artificial intelligence he's built that is highly predictive. And so he had this date. So we're basically, I say all the time that we're at the point in the timeline of a collapse in government confidence. And he had 2015.75 as when it was the peak and we're on this downward slide. And that was literally the day that Russia essentially said no to Obama's plans to collapse Syria. Like, they moved troops in that day. So that was the kind of high watermark of the globalist American empire, because somebody turned around and said no. Literally the peak. And now here we are with a game show president and you know, people like governing the most powerful country on earth via Twitter and arguing with each other. Like, you can't tell me we're not in a collapse in confidence world. Like, remember when this used to have some sort of gravitas? But that's the same around the world. Like, you can't stop the British Prime Minister from dancing like Elaine in Seinfeld whenever she leaves the country. And you go, you're the Prime Minister of Britain. Please don't do that. Please don't dance like you're an epileptic. And it's, you think, who are these people? What's going on? And if you have a metaphysics that allows for eons to change, for astrology, for cycles to change, for cycles to come to an end, then you just kind of go, well, this is a manifestation of what we're winding up a particular era in human history. As like, just on specific things, QAnon is an op, and I suspect it is for, I think the weaponization of alternate media worked so well for whoever the people behind Trump are heading into the election, that this is a ongoing project that can be scaled up and down and will absolutely be scaled up heading into the election and so on. But I think this is them working out, as we all stopped watching mainstream media, there we've now got projects running to work out how you can capture mind share and essentially weaponize digital media in a distributed world. And so that takes two forms. That takes the kind of knee-jerk and bizarre different bannings of different things on Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and whatever. So there's that. And then there's also longer running projects. And that's what I think QAnon is. I think that whatever team is running that, I think they're testing how they can have a sort of shadow state owned alternate news community. And that's what it looks like to me. I definitely don't think, I don't think, he's had a while. If the game show president was going to round up the cabal, like, look, I'd be all for it. Like Washington really is a swamp. Like, go for it. Get them. I don't think that's going to, I don't think that's how it works. I don't think that's how it ever works. However, you've got these mind viruses. It's fascinating. Like, mind viruses and the kind of, I don't even want to call them leftists, but like the liberal centrists have the Russia mind virus. And then you have these kind of like, utterly weaponized Trump fans who think he's, you know, playing four-dimensional chess with billionaires and it's going to round, and it's so fascinating. It's such a fascinating time to be alive. It is also kind of alarming, but my read on QAnon is it's an op, it's a testing op, so it's a program to work out how messages get shaped in a sort of post-mainstream media world.
I'm glad you said that. I tend to agree with you on that one. And you mentioned the censorship. This is getting very concerning. I mean, you know, especially for things like I do, you know, trying to interview people about controversial topics. I could be shut down any day just by saying the wrong word now on YouTube. Yep. And it's getting crazy. What are your thoughts on where we're going with this whole censorship?
Oh, that's absolutely going to get worse. And so, because my background's digital media, and I, when I was working in, worked for Yelp and companies like that in London. And so I had friends at Facebook at a quite senior level, and same thing with Twitter and so on. Like, there is, when I look at how I let me just turn it into advice instead, because this is going to get worse before it gets better. If it ever gets better, do not ever trust a publicly listed private company that backends into DARPA as your kind of like speech platform ever. Like, use it, but if so, you have to be everywhere and you have to have as much sovereignty over your own stuff as possible, so your own website and so on, because they're going to get shut down in different ways and for different reasons, and there will be no recourse. So you'll wake up and maybe you won't be on Twitter or whatever, and that's just where we are. So and funnily enough, it never works. So it just means you're like, more people will be interested in getting your newsletter and the kind of stuff that you can control. But that's where we're going. And the thing is, it kills itself. So no, I haven't used Facebook for years. I have a Facebook page for the podcast, but I have not logged into my account. People keep asking my family if I'm dead, because like, they'll visit the page and I haven't been on since 2014 or whatever. They're like, oh, did he die? Sorry about that. And like, no, he's just weird. But like, none of the steps that Facebook in particular will take will make Facebook more enjoyable. Everyone who is on it is not having a good time, and they are trying to work out where they go next. And so that'll be the first one to go. Then it'll be Twitter and so on. Like, they're making their own products worse by doing this, and so we just kind of need to work out what that is in the medium term. But just, it is a these are all private companies that back end into various, like, you know, DARPA funding and the rest of it. It's not a public space for free speech. It's like, it's corporate owned. It is. It, like, I don't know how we can help people who have mistaken being on Facebook for, you know, access to a library or being able to speak in the town square. Like, these are two different things. You should speak in the town square more, maybe. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. It's, I mean, we're living in fascinating times, but like you said, it's concerning and terrifying at the same time. Now,
yeah, it gets better. It just gets worse first. So this is the great hope of a cycle model, like astrology or something. It's that this too shall pass. So yeah, it gets worse, but then it gets better, because it always does.
Yeah, and I can't wait for that to occur.
Right.
Well, for the last few minutes we have, I don't know if you've noticed, but I've noticed a trend in movies and TV shows, and especially on Netflix now, of a lot of shows and movies about magic and occult practices. Like for example, the new Sabrina. I mean, it took a real dark twist. I don't know if you've seen this.
I have. I liked it.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I thought it was very good. But what are your thoughts on that?
I gave a presentation in January called Speak of the Devil, where I kind of open with, we're in a reverse witch trial situation, whereas back in the day, a lot of people were being accused of witches who probably weren't. And now we have a whole bunch of people declaring themselves witches who probably aren't, right? There's this weird reverse world. And looking historically, European culture has always been interested in the devil as a something to create art about, obviously. So Dante and all the rest of it, and statues and all this kind of thing. The devil has always been like creatively interesting to people who write things, but there is something different. And I made the joke at the opening of the presentation that it's almost easier to list the programs on Netflix that don't include the devil than the ones that do at the moment.
Right. And
I think this is archetypal. I think this is what happens where the archetype, coming back to the model of how the world works, and culture is clearly manipulated, don't get me wrong, but it is also a thing. It also exists to be manipulated, right? So it seems to me that the prominence of the devil as an archetype is, it's almost like it's getting closer to the surface than it has been for a long time, like sort of coming up out of our unconscious as if it was the ocean, closer and closer to the surface, because it is manifesting everywhere, this kind of like devil witchcraft thing. And you can kind of see why, like it flies together with a lot of other revolutionary stuff. I mean, the devil is a revolutionary and a reactionary against a dictator. Like, that's the kind of general Luciferian model, right? And so you kind of see that if that's happening all across culture, which it essentially is, then it would, if the model's correct, that we're talking about the archetype of the devil coming closer and closer to the surface of our collective unconscious, then it would start to erupt like this. So that's what I think that's what's going on there, because I have looked into it. I mean, shows about magic and aliens and so on have very often been used for, you know, programming or deep state reasons, right? Like, you can, there have been deliberate attempts to shape the narrative around things like aliens and the Cold War and whatever in Hollywood and on TV. Absolutely. And so I have looked at this stuff to see if, to me, it looks the same as that. And I can see why people can make the case, but I don't get, like, I get why they did it for aliens, and I get why they did it for the Cold War. I don't get why they, you end up with a model of the super elite being in some sort of all in the one satanic cult. And I've been around really, really, really rich people. I've been occasionally useful to them in London. They don't believe anything. They don't believe anything. God, it'd be easier if they were Satanists. But so, yeah, I think it's that. I have a kind of back alley Jungian interpretation for it, although I'm prepared to be wrong. And in individual shows, I'm sure I am. I'm sure there are specific messages that are supposed to get out. And Netflix, this is another example. So the kind of like leftish-ish rather than ist side of how we manipulate a post-mainstream media culture, you put the Obamas on the board at Netflix. And so it's kind of like Netflix is the liberal centrist QAnon, if that makes sense. So you've got this project going over here and that one going there. I think they're trying to work out how they maintain message control, because it obviously got away from some of them a couple of years ago. And that's kind of what I'm seeing. So for sure, in the case of Netflix, it's just very interesting to see that the messaging falls directly into a centrist Democrat line the whole time. So there's something going on there. But if we're talking specifically about things like Sabrina and so on, I defer to Jung rather than the Pentagon in my analysis.
Very good. And at the same time, we're also seeing a rise in sort of the transhuman thing and a lot of robots. Yeah. They had a new one that came out. I think it was Sex, Death, and Robots. I don't know if you've seen this one yet. It's very interesting.
I haven't. I've seen it on the on the menu page, but I haven't actually watched it. Yeah, the transhuman thing is more likely to be a project, in my estimation, than the sort of upwelling of the devil in art and culture. I think that's just a thing that art and culture go through phases like that, right? That's the cycle model. So the transhuman thing seems more like an actual project to me that has all the hallmarks of, and probably an alarming one, but they're insane. The singularity and uploading yourself into some sort of self-driving Uber on Mars to live forever, like, is...
Yeah, there's so many shows about uploading your consciousness to a robot.
The people who are walking around with billions of dollars who believe this are insane. That's like the most... This comes back to that, I don't think you can model this without believing in the demonic or having some understanding of the demonic, because that is someone who is possessed by an entity that wants to, like, the devil's cleverest wile is to make you believe he doesn't exist, right? And this is one of those examples. If a sort of truly satanic entity would want to convince you that there is only the physical, there's only the material. And so that's what this is. And I look at it and go, You're literally possessed. A demon has told you that the only thing that exists is this, and he's given you a false promise. Like, that's my model for it. And that's, as a result, like, I think the transhuman thing is a way of beginning to normalize some law changes that will be required to do the things that we currently find abhorrent, but that come along with the transhumanist project. So I think nicey-nicey sex and robots and all that is part of that process, because transhumanism is still very human. It's still very icky. It still requires a lot of things done that we're maybe not fans of. And the trouble is, this is why it's that kind of literally and metaphorically satanic idea, is in a material universe, it's not just that the only things that exist are material, it's all the one substance. So there's actually no moral difference between the body of a child and a rock. And so that's the kind of law change stuff that's happening. It's like, well, if we're all just molecules, then it doesn't really matter. Let's combine and recombine. That's my guess as to what the transhumanism as project thing is heading towards. They're going to have to bring some laws and make cultural changes that we would currently find abhorrent.
Yeah, very strange. Yeah, we live in fascinating times. And Gordon, I want to thank you again so much for coming on tonight. I have like a whole other page of shit we could have talked about. So you're going to have to come back on. That was
excellent. Sounds good.
Great, great.
Well, happy to.
You have a great night then.
Yeah, all right, you too.